would contain about 3,000 million pairs of the DNA genetic alphabet, which is ATCD. The information would be overwhelming, since just one single DNA molecule contains enough information to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. So here's a tiny cell, the tail, this is the flagellum, and you've cut it, it's been cut open. You can't see this with the naked eye. Inside this little tiny microscopic organism is a strand of DNA. Inside that DNA, that one strand, is enough information to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. That's a lot of information. You should keep that in mind when we look at the small things tonight. This is also another overview or a cross-section of a cell. The amount of information contained in a single human cell, not just a DNA molecule, so we're looking a little bit bigger now, inside the cell is equivalent to all 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica several times over. And all that is not inside a fully formed human, just inside of a single cell. So information, this kind of information, this kind of intricate, amazingly vast information is inside of a piece of something that you can't see with the naked eye. That's pretty amazing. What is known about the simplest of life forms is that they contain the information equivalent of 1,000 encyclopedias. That's a lot of books. Encyclopedias have that 0.6 font or 6-point font, and it's just copy dense all the way throughout. That's a lot of information. Yet the complex human life form not only has trillions of cells, we were talking about one cell earlier, it is also producing millions of new cells each second. So where did all that information originate? It seems to point logically to a designer, at least to me. So I'm presenting this tonight that I think there's a designer. Now, when we start talking, people talk about evolution. How did evolution start? Well, there was a primordial soup of stuff. Don't know where that came from, but the idea is that somehow, some way, everything kind of lined up and it became life. Well, we're taking it down to the microscopic subatomic area. We're talking about the smallest of the small. Can the smallest of the small, you know, that single-celled thing, become everything? Show you tonight, and you'll be convinced it's absolutely impossible. That can't happen. No way in a million years. Not 4.6 billion years. Bruce Albert says this. The entire cell, I love this quote, the next two quotes. The entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines. Why do we call them machines? Precisely because, like machines invented by humans to deal efficiently with the macroscopic world, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts. Piercy and Thaxton say this: the cell would resemble a fully automated modern factory. And just imagine what they're imagining is that, let's take the cell on its microscopic level and let's just enlarge it. And you and I are going to go into it. We're going to walk around and look into the cell. We would see a vast range of products and raw materials continually passing through conduits in an orderly fashion to various assembly plants. We would see robot-like machines, tens of thousands of different kinds, in charge of production. These are the proteins. Some of them, enzymes, act as catalysts, regulating the cell's processes like little robots with stopwatches. In fact, we would see analogs to nearly every feature of our own advanced machines. Much of the terminology needed to describe this fascinating molecular reality, we would have to borrow from late 20th century technology. Here's a picture of something like that. Inside of a cell. And if you look at it, I don't know how well you can see the words on it, but you've got the nutrients walking in. The cell membrane is that outer one. The inner one is called the nucleus there. You know that in the middle. In the back, you've got these machines. Fats and lipids, amino acids are being, and it's going through what looks like a tiny machine. It's like a factory under these microscopes to see a single cell. In other words, it'd be easy for evolutionists, and it always has been, to say there was a single cell. Don't know how it got there, but just a single cell. We think of that as just so rudimentary, just a single cell. But inside the single cell, there's so much information and things going on that if you enlarge it, it's a factory. What does it take to build a factory? Intelligence, a designer, right? So even though we've got this tiny little cell, you make it big, and it shows. How many of you saw my one of my favorite movies is The Hunt for Red October. The book's better, but the and you know when the guy who's tracking the Red October, he hears this sound and he records it, and it sounds like whales out in the distance. He says, "But I sped it up, and here's what it sounds 10 times that speed." And it was going. He said, "Now that's got to be man-made. That kind of sound. When you look at something like this, you say that's got to be man-made. That's got to be made by something designing it, or someone." Here's another picture of a cell, just to show you how intricately designed a single cell is. It's I tried to get a picture and show the scale of a cell, and it had everyone had a coffee bean, a grain of rice, and it was just down to, you couldn't see it. It was just a dot compared to the coffee bean. Obviously, you can't see a cell. How many of you ever heard of a guy named Michael Behe? Wrote a book in the early 90s called Darwin's Black Box. And Behe became, through that, an advocate of intelligent design, the ID movement. Doesn't mean they're Christians, doesn't mean they believe in God. It's a movement in the right direction, but it's not a bunch of Christians. Anyway, Behe made some astounding finds. He said, "Since cells do nothing until all their components are fully in place, it is impossible to imagine how the evolutionary idea of natural selection could have created them from simpler processes, since effective simpler processes do not exist." Behe calls this irreducible complexity. Quote, "A system or device is irreducibly complex if it has a number of different components that all work together to accomplish the task of any system. And if you were to remove one of the components, the system would no longer function. Everything works together." What he's going to say over time as he gets through this, he says, look, evolution is the idea of something being added this millions of years. A couple millions later, years later, something else is added, then something else, and in a billion years, that thing comes together. Well, he's showing this is absolutely impossible. The only way for this thing that is life to come together is if it comes together all at once, because it's only life if it comes together all at once. Take, for example, and he uses a mousetrap. He says it needs a wooden platform, a metal for crushing, a spring with extended ends to press against the platform, and the hammer when the trap is charged, the catch that releases when a mouse touches it, and a metal bar that connects to the catch and holds the hammer back when the trap is charged. If any one of these parts is taken away or not precisely positioned, the mouse trap is useless since it cannot work without its parts. Now, this actually shows my own maturity, this picture, because there was lots of pictures with a dead mouse in it already, and I didn't want to put that up there. So I thought, no, I'll grow up a little bit tonight. But look at this little piece. It's got 5 pieces. Very rudimentary piece. It's absolutely worthless if any one of those parts are not there. It has to be there all at once. That's his point. Now, this is just take a cheap piece of wood, a couple of cheap pieces of metal, make a spring, twist it all together. If a mousetrap requires that much intelligence to make, how much more a cell with all the amazing millions and billions of pieces of information in it? That's his point. If a simple mousetrap cannot evolve over time, and we know it can't, without intelligent manipulation, how could a single cell with its intricate design and information suddenly appear and evolve over time, with chance guiding it, to form life as we know it? And if it did, what is the origin for all the information inside that cell? Scientifically speaking, since we know that nothing that complex can be created on Earth without a designer, why would we relegate such intricacies to evolution and chance? Believing the cell just appeared by chance takes far more faith than believing it was created. Do you agree with that? It's essentially what we have. We're talking about 2 different kinds of faith. One has science that points to it. You use scientific research, and as you do scientific research and studies, everything points to a creator. The other has none of that, so if you're going to agree that it was created by chance, then you've got more faith over here than you do over here, which points to God. The problem is, faith is not what saves. It is the object of our faith that saves. There's lots of people with faith. Everyone has faith. Unbelievers, atheists have faith that there is no God. They have great faith that there is no God. Mormons believe in several gods. Pantheists believe in several gods, or God in everything. They have great faith, but faith isn't what saves. It's the object of our faith, that is, Jesus Christ our Lord. Here's a picture of a cell with a flagellum. It's a bacteria. It's a bacteria cell. The cell itself is not just irreducibly complex. The very parts of the cell are irreducibly complex. There is the bacterial flagellum, the tail-like projection that protrudes from the cell body of certain prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. You remember those cells? Sure you do. Just don't tell us, right? This tail both steers the cell and senses chemicals and temperatures outside the cell. Behe says, while cilia act like oars and move cells, the flagellum, and cilia is like this hairy substance around a cell. It kind of helps it move around and manipulate its way through wherever it's going. The flagellum is what performs like a rotary propeller. Just picture an outboard motor on a boat, and you get the pretty good idea of how the flagellum functions. Only the flagellum is far more incredible. The flagellum's propeller is long and whip-like, made out of a protein called flagellin. This is attached to a drive shaft. I love these words. A drive shaft by hook protein, which acts as a universal joint, allowing the propeller to drive drive shaft to rotate freely. So here's a close-up of a flagellum. Okay, you see it there. There's the tip at the end. You've got this hook. I don't have a... Yeah, let's see if my laser works here. Not really. It's a little dim. The hook is that blue joint right there at the top. Well, you can see it, can't you? You can read that, yeah. The hook. You've got the L ring, the rod, the P ring. Any of you who work on cars, this looks like some piece under the hood. Unscrew this, put that there. That's what it looks like, just a cross-section of the flagellum. Mind you, the flagellum is coming out, so you don't see all of this inside the cell. The cell wall, the stator, the MS ring, C ring, type 3 sectional system, the inner membrane, all of these are working parts. What are they made of? Proteins. Different kinds of proteins that are actually the pieces and parts that make this thing. Irreducibly complex. That flagellum is not going to work unless all of those things are working together at the same time. They cannot evolve because it never would have existed if any one of those pieces was not there. Here it is. I don't know how well you can see it from there, but can you see the ridges there? They're like train tracks that thing is working on. Interworking parts. When you look down, Michael Behe is just looking at this cell, and the researchers that do, you can see this thing at its microscopic level and see the pieces and the parts and the way they work. Now, if the cell is microscopic, flagellum is microscopic, you look into it and you're turning it on, and here these are small things. And they're loaded with information, and they're like little outboard motors. Behe said several types of proteins act as brushing material to allow the drive shaft to penetrate the bacterial wall and attach to the rotary motor. The rotary motor. This was the design of our God. There's no way these things come together by chance. Addressing what might be steering the cell, Behe says it turns out that it has sensory systems that feed into the bacteria flagellum and tell it when to turn on and when to turn off, so that it guides it to food, light, or whatever it's seeking, and the flagellum is irreducibly complex. It's like it has a personality with a leader showing it where to go. Behe continues, genetic studies have shown that between 30 and 35 proteins are needed to create a functional flagellum. At a minimum, you need at least three parts, a paddle, a rotor, and a motor, that are made up of various proteins. Eliminate one of those parts and you don't get a flagellum that only spins at 5,000 RPMs. You get a flagellum that simply doesn't work at all. 30 to 35 proteins. How do they all know to come together like that? See, our designing God, our Creator, put them there. How is that so difficult to imagine? The odds against that render it completely hopeless. The information content of the human brain, if written out in English, would fill some 20 million volumes, as many as the world's largest library. So think of the world's biggest library you've ever been in, Library of Congress. That is 20 million volumes. I'm not sure how many the Library of Congress has. It might have more. But if you've ever been into a big library, you see all these books, you think, wow, if I could have one wish, Lord, it would be that I have all the information in these books right in here. Guess what? It's already there. Information, what's going on in this between these two temples is already there. That's the information that's there. We're talking about a cell. Now we're talking about what's in our brain, in the human brain. How did that get there? Information comes from an intelligent one that has information, right? How do you get information? How do you take a flash drive, and it's empty. You put it in your computer. How's it going to get that information if you don't put it in your computer? Is there some way, some possibility that that flash drive is going to get everything that's in the computer? Think of your computer as God. This is where the information begins. The information is put in here, or the lack of information is put into the computer. It's transferred over. Bam. That's how everything else we do on the planet works. Why would we think, or why would we give some ridiculous notion that that flash drive one day will have all the information in this computer? Just give it enough time. How did it get there? By chance, or as Richard Dawkins surmises, did aliens put it there? Did it come from crystals? I like to make fun of Richard Dawkins. I enjoy making fun of people that like us to believe they're really smart when they're really absolute fools. Behe said that the probability of getting one protein molecule, which has about 100 amino acids, by chance, would be the same as blindfolding a man or a blindfolded man finding one marked grain of sand in the Sahara Desert three times in a row. Yet one protein molecule is not life. Let's just say he did do that. There's no life in that. To get life, you would need to get about 200 of those protein molecules together. Chance is not a cause. It's a young man we know and love that sits in the back. But chance is just a word we use to mask our ignorance. Right? You don't know how to do it, just throw chance in there. Carl Sagan says this, the late Carl Sagan. The information content of the human brain, expressed in bits, is comparable to the total number of connections among neurons, about 100 trillion. If written out in English, that information would fill some 20 million volumes, as many as the world's largest libraries. The equivalent of 20 million books is inside the heads of every one of us. The neurochemistry of the brain is astonishingly busy, the circuitry of a machine more wonderful than any devised by humans. This is Carl Sagan. Did not believe in God, absolutely, completely rejected God, and he believes that the brain is filled with this information. And he's right, of course. So, movie Contact. He was convinced, from his CD, The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, convinced that a simple string of prime numbers coming from outer space proves the existence of an intelligent being or beings. Yet the equivalent of 1,000 encyclopedias in the first one-cell life does not. How ridiculous is that? I laughed at him last week for this. He, by his own admission, admits all the information that's in the brain. He has no idea how it got there. But if he could just find a simple string of prime numbers coming from outer space, a little bit of intelligent information, he would say that there's life out there. Why can't he take the life that's already here and recognize there's a designer, an intelligent being? Macro versus microevolution. Microevolution is the when you talk about changes within a species. Dogs mating with other dog breeds, and they've got changes within the within the species, but they remain what? Dogs. Little changes. Moths go through changes. They remain moths. Birds go through various changes, beak sizes, what have you. Some adapt to their environment, but they always remain that which they are. Always. There's not a shred of any evidence anywhere ever in the history of the world that there anything becomes goes from a bird to being a dog, for instance, or a tree. In fact, I'll never forget when I was probably, I had to be 6, 7 years old. I was watching The Cosmos on PBS back when we had four channels, right? Back in the 70s. And Carl Sagan is on there, and he's talking like Carl Sagan talks. And he's standing next to a tree, and he grabs the tree, and he said, like this tree. And he literally hugs the tree, and he says, this tree is like my brother. He didn't say like my brother. This tree is my brother. I thought, huh? I mean, I'm 6, 7 years old. I'm going, I don't know that this guy knows, but I, Mom, is the tree our brother? Stop watching PBS. So I was watching Sesame Street, and this crazy guy came on. So when we're talking about microevolution, we're talking about small changes. Macro is that change we were talking about from a cat to a dog. The Darwinist conundrum is this. If macroevolution is possible, that is, a change in species, and science gives no evidence that it is. How does new life come into existence when there is still no explanation as to where the first life came from? How can you have new life? You don't even know where the first life came from. Natural selection is what we would call a misnomer. It's a bad word for if or bad because it implies intelligent. Someone's doing the selecting, doesn't it? For if the process of evolution is, by definition, without intelligence, there's no selection going on, right? Survival of the fittest is actually true. But all that survive remain what they inherently are. Bacteria evolve stronger against antibiotics. The more you take it, the more your body's going to develop a resistance to those particular antibiotics. You know that. But they remain bacteria. Dogs and cats evolve, yet there are not dats or cogs. Thought you'd like that. Micro concerns changes within a species. Macro concerns changes into another one. Never been observed ever. And that's the kind of the theme of that Ray Comfort one where he's at UCLA. And he's just saying, you know, he goes up and asks him, can you give me an example of how one species changed to another species? And every one of them go, oh, there's thousands of examples. Just give me one. And there's always that silence. You got to watch this video if you haven't seen it. It's just too good not to. It's sad, but you'll laugh throughout it. Sad not because we're losing, but because people actually believe that garbage. So why not natural selection? Well, genetic limits are built into a species, thus all things remain as they are. God did not build a species to become something else. Our genetic makeup has limits. Cyclical change. Changes do not produce new life forms. They simply shift back and forth within a limited range. For example, Darwin's finches that he saw in the Galapagos Islands had various beak sizes, which correlated with the weather. But finches remained finches. Irreducible complexity, which we saw a minute ago under Michael Behe's terminology, composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. Oprah Winfrey did a thing a few years ago on the Earth, and she just gets on there and she starts talking about dinosaurs and how dinosaurs became birds. Just like that. Dinosaurs became birds. No explanation. You're just supposed to hear that and say, that's true. Well, I went and looked it up, and I'm going back, and I saw, because I knew Michael Behe's terminology, I learned that feathers are irreducibly complex. Scales on a dinosaur cannot become a feather. The feather has to be all working feather all at one time. It cannot evolve. Furthermore, what is a reptile? What color, what kind of blood does it have? What is a bird? Cold-blooded to warm-blooded? Tell me this doesn't take faith. But Oprah Winfrey's got a TV show. She's a multi-billionaire, and she's able to say that. And you, your kids are watching it, somebody's watching it, and they just, dinosaurs became birds. That makes sense. Dinosaurs one day quit being big and roaming the earth, and they grew feathers. Got to be true. It's on TV. Oprah said it. Irreducible complexity is scientific evidence that it cannot happen. In other words, all the parts of each machine must be completely formed in the right places, in the right sizes, in operating order, at the same time for the machine to function, as in a car engine or a watch, intermediates are non-functional. And what I didn't tell you, what I remember very specifically about Carl Sagan hugging that tree. And he said, this tree, this is my brother. And he said, it's very important that you know this, very important that you know this. And kind of out of character, because it really didn't look scripted to the show. He said, evolution, and let me say something about evolution. It's a fact. Did you hear me? It's a fact. And I thought, wow, if it's a fact, why do you need to tell me that? I mean, why do you need to go back and say, this is true, if, in fact, you already know it's true? You got to keep saying it. You got to keep brainwashing people through the years and say that. Now you say, well, Lance, you tell people that the fact that Christ is God. Yes, I do. I'm telling you because I'm announcing something that people don't know. Certainly Sagan could be doing the same thing. They may not know that evolution is true or false. So imagine you've got these two world religions, world views, and both sides trying to push their argument. Which one's right? Well, which one does science prove? Let's put faith out for a second, just for the sake of argument. Which one does science prove? Every time. If God created the world, then it's always going to show up that he did so. And if he created science, then science is always going to push or I should say point toward its creator. And then there's the non-viability of transitional forms. That means they don't happen. Transitional forms could not survive. How could a creature survive that no longer has scales but does not quite have feathers? And feathers are irreducibly complex. They're not going to survive. What are these animals? Plus, you would expect that if a dinosaur is going to evolve into a bird, what are you going to look for in the middle? Some fossils somewhere, right? Because there's going to be a lot of death. A lot of dying before the last dinosaur. And how is that last dinosaur finally going to become a bird? They're all going to die before they become birds. Why do we even have to? This sounds so stupid to even say it out loud. Darwinists have no viable mechanism for getting from reptiles to birds. And even if a viable mechanism were discovered, the transitional forms would be eaten and not survive, for they would not be fit. The molecular isolation. Darwinists think the DNA, and when I talk about Darwinists, if you don't already know, that's an evolutionist. They think that the DNA similarity between apes and humans, which is between 85 and 95% similar, implies an ancestral relationship. Well, if they're 85 and 95% the same, then they must be the exact same, right? Well, possibly we have one common genetic code because we have a common creator. To live in the same biosphere, possibly that. If every living creature were distinct biochemically, a food would not likely exist. Some protein evidence composed of long chains of chemical units called amino acids. These are the building blocks of life. Some of you drink these things. Want to get your protein in and that let the protein break down into the amino acids. And, you know, most young bodybuilders, they don't know what that means, but got to get my protein, got my amino acids. And those things start building up muscle tissue when you break them down. Well, they're composed of long chains of chemical units. Most proteins have in their structure more than 100 of these amino acids, which must be in a very specific order. It is the DNA that contains the instructions for ordering the amino acids in the proteins. And the order is critical because any variation usually renders the protein dysfunctional. If all species share a common ancestor, we should find, or expect to find, protein sequences that are transitional from, say, fish to amphibian or from reptile to mammal. Instead, we find that the basic types are molecularly isolated from one another, which seems to produce or preclude any type of ancestral relationships. It's got to be exact. An ape, to be a human, has got to be 90. They have to be the same one. We have a common creator, and any tweak in each one makes that into the form that God made it to be. At a molecular level, there's no trace of the evolutionary transition from fishes to amphibians or from reptiles to mammals. So amphibians, always traditionally considered intermediate between fish and the other terrestrial vertebrates, are in molecular terms as far from fish as any group of reptiles or mammals. You have any questions or comments at this point? A lot of slides, a lot of information. Okay, good. Fossil record. How many of you have heard of Stephen Jay Gould? I read a book on Stephen Jay Gould one time, and I had my professor was in a graduate program in psychology, and I was studying the brain. Is the brain, if a brain is bigger, does that make you smarter? Smaller, make you dumber? And I pulled up this particular book, and I wrote a book review on it. My professor ripped me. She said, "I want to know what you think. Don't give me a book report. You're not in high school anymore. I want to know what you think." I don't need to be told twice. So I picked up, I went to the library, and I found a book by Stephen Jay Gould called The Mismeasure of Man. And I read it, and I ripped it. And I thought, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever read, and I laid into it. And come to find out, she was a Christian, the only one I knew in graduate school. And she wrote back, she said, "Hey, now that's an opinion." Good. So anyway, Stephen Jay Gould, he's the late Stephen Jay Gould, and he is without a doubt a creationist now, but not with Jesus. He said the history of the fossil species is inconsistent with gradualism. Now, this is a Darwinist. He knows. He invented, after this, after all his research, and he was a very intelligent man, after all his research, he said, look, I believe in, what did he call it? Reed, what did he call it? punctuated equilibrium. Bam, it just comes into being. There's no evolution. Things don't evolve. It just, it's there. And then it's there. Punctuated equilibrium. Wow. And that's interesting because that's what the Bible says. It was just created. Stasis. Most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappear. Sudden appearance. In any local area, a species does not arise gradually by the steady transformation of its ancestors. It appears all at once and fully formed. So when you take the fossil record, you would expect in the fossil record to find, okay, there were whatever. You ever seen, everyone has seen the picture of the man that's a monkey, and then he graduates, and then one day, you know, this was originally a drawing. It was never was it a scientific research project put together. It was a drawing by a particular man put together. It's still, was it, have you ever been to the Golden Gate Park? Was I talking to you about this last week? Who was I talking about? Golden Gate Park. Go to Golden Gate Park. Maybe it was your mom. And it was a. That's what's there. You see these pictures, Grand Canyon. You go out to these places. You see these things. They're still trying to push this on people. It's never happened. There's never been. One would expect. Okay, if you saw the monkey and then there's the man, you would see all the fossils of them in between. None. You say, what about Neanderthal man? You know about Neanderthal man? If you take Neanderthal man and shave him, put a coat and tie on him. He's you and me. He's just a human being, Homo sapien. There are no in-betweens. There are none. What about Lucy? How many of you know who Lucy is? Study Lucy. Lucy was a chimpanzee, an orangutan. She walked on her hands like this. All the research that tries to show that she wasn't is just digging for something, some kind of clue. And then, of course, there's been there's the hoaxes of Nebraska man, Piltdown man, where they found a pig's tooth and built an entire exhibit around a pig's tooth with this half man, half ape pulling his wife by the hair. Cavemen, right? And then it comes out it was a pig's tooth. Everything built around a pig's tooth? Yeah. That's what it was. Yeah. The evolutionist idea, as I understand it, is that is the explanation for space aliens, is man evolved into that. You and I have not gotten there yet. Is that the existence of aliens and flying saucers is man at its higher level, at his higher level. Why are there still apes? I don't know. Why have we not gotten there yet? You got to have some explanation, right? It would depend on who you ask. Five reasons to believe in intelligent design. Do you need these five reasons? Well, I'm not going to let you go early, so let's look at them. Number one, life does not consist merely of chemicals. If that were the case, mixing the chemicals of life in a test tube would produce life. Life also includes specified complexity, which comes only from an intelligent mind. Therefore, materialism, that is the belief that which can be seen in itself or touched is real, is false. Materialism is the view of Darwinism. Is there's no spiritual. You are alive. You will die. You will rot in the ground. That's it. It's over. Which, again, I make fun of people, people's views of death, and I don't want to be insensitive about people's views of death, but I always make fun of the Darwinists because, you know, they go through a car wreck and they live and they go, wow, I'm so thankful I'm alive. Why? I mean, to who? Who are you thankful to? But no, if you were dead, would you be rotting in the ground going, this stinks? In your own view, you're dead. Yeah, there's no thought. You're not going, this is uncomfortable. You're dead. So what are you worried about? Better to be alive than dead. How do you know? I mean, there's lots of pains in this world. If you just don't exist and you're dust, why is that so bad? But if you're a Christian and you know that when you die, you're going to heaven, what are you worried about dying for that way too? Death is so overblown. Now, we as Christians, we definitely mourn the deaths of those that we don't believe are believers. And we have a heart for them. We want them to know the truth. But life doesn't consist of chemicals. Life is not materialistic in the sense that that's all there is. A materialist will say life is all there is. And yet they believe in love. Yet they believe in humor. I believe in aesthetics or beauty. Those things are not materialistic. Number two, there are no known natural laws that create information, that is, specified complexity. Only intelligence has been observed to creating specified complexity or information. That's why Darwinists cannot explain the origin of the first life. The idea of survival assumes order and fitness. The DNA, the letters that denote DNA, A, C, G, and T, is specified complexity. It contains a specific message. Where'd that come from? Number three, the simplest life consists of specified complexity, equivalent to 1,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. The origin of life can only be surmised through forensics, thus it should be pieced together from the evidence. Number four, science is a search for causes that is built on philosophy. I should have put good philosophy. There are only two types of causes, that is, be intelligent and natural. Darwinists philosophically rule out intelligent causes, so when they look at those 1,000 encyclopedias, despite observing and recognizing their obvious design, they assert that their cause must be natural. And of course, this takes great faith. And number five, spontaneous generation of life, which Darwinism requires to get the theory started, has never been observed. Thus, they believe it on faith and mask it as science. Don't miss that. It's masked as science. Nothing scientific about it. What is science? Science is doing experiments, observing things, and then drawing conclusions from the observation. If this has never been observed, how can it be science? How can it be scientific? Should time be given more time so that chance can put it all together? Well, let's assume, take a deck of cards. You got a deck of cards, and you're in an airplane. Put yourself in an airplane, and you're flying low to the ground. You drop the deck of cards. Let's say you've got the pieces of the American flag. That's a better example. Pieces of the American flag. And if you drop the pieces of the American flag low to the ground and they fall, what are the odds of it falling to the ground and looking like a perfect American flag? What if you go up higher and give it more time to 30,000 feet and drop the pieces of the American flag? Does it have a greater chance? Well, that's what you do with evolution. Let's give it more time so that chance can take care of it and it will become that. Well, common sense says that doesn't work either. The second law of thermodynamics proves that more time only brings more chaos. We know that. If our house is a mess, you can't leave your home. When you go on vacation, your house is a mess and you think, you know what, if I just give my house enough time, I get back, it'll be clean. That's right. It's worth a try. Yeah, Tracy.
In terms of giving it more time, don't they already? If they claim that the world is Earth is already millions of years old, how many more millions of years? You know what I'm saying?
How many more millions of years? What?
For whatever, for the next step or the next.
Oh, till something else happens.
Time is needed for.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. What goes on in the news today? What's the big one of the big hot buttons on our planet today in politics? Global warming. Because they know the Earth's going to get, we're going to ruin the Earth, right? If they see the Earth deteriorating, they want to blame it on humans when they have no evidence of that. I'm not even sure the evidence really doesn't point even to it actually being warmer. So they see it going that way. So where do they think it's going to go in a million years? There's an old experiment years ago, and they said that the sun itself loses a certain amount of mass every second. It's burning out. And over time, it will completely burn out. Well, if you went back 4.6 billion years, if the sun is this big today, 4.6 billion years ago would have been like this, something like that, that much bigger. Earth never would have had a chance. The moon is the same way. 4.6 billion years ago, the moon would have been resting on the Earth. If you take that, now I've read, I actually put that in a research paper years ago, and I read it somewhere, I said, you can't do that, it's not the way it works. But every research paper I've read, the modern day research, keeps saying the same thing. If you just reverse the whole thing, you come back, it doesn't work that way. If the Earth itself is eternal, well, we know that what the Earth has and what it makes would run out. It's running out. If it was eternal, it would already have run out of its resources. It can't. We see it running out, as you say. And in politics, we try to save it that way. You know that I was in Monterey a couple weeks ago, and we were at the aquarium there in Monterey, California, and you sit out in the Monterey, all the otters are out there. It's just pretty funny. The otters are pretty nifty little animals, and they live out in the ocean, and then you see the whales out there and everything. Anyway, you go in the aquarium, and it's very Darwinistic. And I just thought, for the first time, I thought, it's so arrogant to think what we humans think, because in the shows, we have to do this. We humans, we were doing this. It's the only way for us to preserve these otters. I'm going, the sea is so big. It's so powerful, so vast. You really think you can do that? Things go out of existence every day. Species go extinct every day as part of the natural way, as part of survival of the fittest in some way. As I told you last week, it's good that, I think I told you, yeah, we talked about earthquakes. Earthquakes are actually good for the earth. Cheryl was telling me an example the other day. I had never heard it before. You may have heard it before. A preacher was using as an example. He said, forest fires are absolutely positively necessary. If they didn't happen, they burn up the ground. There's certain iron materials in the ground that wouldn't sustain life if it wasn't burning up and replenishing itself. Anyway, this guy was using it in terms of to illustrate how we go through tough times. And those tough times, they burn us, and they make us better to go to the next level. So I thought it was a good example. But the second law of thermodynamics proves that you don't need more time. More time just makes things worse, as you can see with your house or your car. So some conclusions. John Lennox from Oxford says this: is it not to be wondered at that our archaeologist immediately infers intelligent origin when faced with a few simple scratches? That's the scratches we looked at last week on the walls of the caves. Some scientists, when faced with a 3 billion letter sequence of the human genome, inform us that it is to be explained solely in terms of chance and necessity. I like his look, that sarcastic look. Is it design or is it chance? This is a rose window at York Minster Museum or Church. This is a view along the axis of the DNA double helix. The one on the left is designed by a man, by a person, and we know that it would never get that way were it not. Why would we not look at the same thing down the double helix of a DNA and think anything different? Now that one, and that one's so much more intricate, that must have come together by chance. The other one has to be human, but this has got to be chance. One design, one by chance. Atheists are actually guilty of stealing biblical truth. Christian worldview on personhood. The intellect and conceptual thought, they believe this, or we believe the Christian worldview on personhood. We believe that man has intellect and conceptual thought. We believe that man has the freedom to choose and a free will. We believe that man has ethical responsibility, that is, standards to live by. We believe that man has moral accountability and obligations. We believe in inalienable rights of personhood. Disagreeing with each other only proves that it's correct. These, along with reason, logic, design, and truth, only exist if God exists. Take these out, and you've got intellect, freedom of will, or free will, ethical responsibility, moral accountability. Where did these come from? They would not exist if there was no God. Logic, reason, these things, if they exist, and they do, have to have something behind them that created it. Science itself is a slave to philosophy, to good philosophy. Science cannot prove mathematics and logic. Science cannot prove metaphysical truth. It is why we know anything at all. Science cannot prove ethics. Science cannot prove aesthetics, that which is beautiful. Science cannot prove science itself. You have to use science to prove science. Remember, I told you a couple weeks ago there are people out there called rationalists. Why do you believe in rationalism? Because I believe we should be rational. Why? Well, you have to use rational thought to prove that you're a rationalist. That's called a circular argument. If you have to assume it to prove it, then you're what's called begging the question. Begging the question. Science cannot be done without philosophy. One's philosophy dictates one's science. Science says nothing scientists do. And finally, Anthony Flew, who is a former outspoken atheist, says this: I think the origins of the laws of nature and of life and the universe point clearly to an intelligent source. Wow, thank you, Anthony. That changes everything. The burden of proof is on those who argue to the contrary. And I like what Josh McDowell says about that. He says, look, if you don't believe, you're the one with the problem. You're the one that has to prove that God doesn't exist. There's no intelligent designer. I don't have anything to prove. I can give you evidence, but you're the one with the problem. You're the one that won't believe. Well, that's 2 weeks in teleological argument. It's my favorite argument for the argument for God. It's the most commonsensical, because we can all look around and see that. And the way we live our lives and the things we call science today just fit right in with the teleological argument. Any questions, comments? Yeah, we'll look at the moral argument next week for the existence of God. The moral argument for the existence of God. I think that's the punctuated equilibrium, I think.
Right,
same thing.
Alligator lays an egg and a chicken pops out.
Well, think about if you're a Darwinist. Think if you're an evolutionist. How scary would that be? You've got to make up things like that. You've got to come up with something. You have nothing. Don't forget, again, our good buddy Richard Dawkins, this intelligent Oxford professor of zoology, his best example is that the earth was seeded by aliens. That example has got to tell you something. These guys don't have anything. There's other, I've got a whole book, it's that thick. It's put together, it's edited by a guy named, it's the late Henry Morris. And he says that their words may be used against them. And he quotes them decade after decade. All the things that they say, it's their words against them. They're talking to each other going, we don't have a clue. We have no idea. They're admitting to each other in their own journals. One guy says in very ostentatious terms, I start off, it's a quote I have in my dissertation on it. He said, look, we can't let these creationists think we don't know what we're talking about, because if we do, they'll get a foot in the door and we'll never get back out. His own words. These guys know they're sunk, but they're not going to believe in God. They got to figure out something.
The intelligent design that came out like 10 years ago.
I don't know that one.
Oh, it's awesome. It starts realizing, wow,
yeah.
What
you're
saying really is stupid.
Yeah. As it goes on, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know how many of you are on my... know my Facebook page, but big Brian Barrington, somebody sent me this video this week, and it's just what we're talking about. It's 5 minutes. That's a good looking family.
My magazine ran a cover story asking, is God dead? The cover reflected the fact that many people had accepted the cultural narrative that God is obsolete, that as science progresses, there's less need for a God to explain the universe. It turns out, though, that the rumors of God's death were premature. In fact, perhaps the best arguments for his existence come from, of all places, science itself. Here's the story. The same year Time featured its now famous headline, the astronomer Carl Sagan announced that there were two necessary criteria for a planet to support life: the right kind of star and a planet the right distance from that star. Given the roughly octillion planets in the universe, that's one followed by 24 zeros, there should have been about septillion planets, that's one followed by 21 zeros, capable of supporting life. With such spectacular odds, scientists were optimistic that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, known by its initials SETI, an ambitious project launched in the 1960s, was sure to turn up something soon. With a vast radio telescopic network, scientists listened for signals that resembled coded intelligence. But as the years passed, the silence from the universe was deafening. As of 2014, researchers have discovered precisely bupkis, nada, zilch, which is to say zero followed by an infinite number of zeros. What happened? As our knowledge of the universe increased, it became clear that there were, in fact, far more factors necessary for life, let alone intelligent life, than Sagan supposed. His two parameters grew to 10, then 20, and then 50, which meant that the number of potentially life-supporting planets decreased accordingly. The number dropped to a few thousand planets and kept on plummeting. Even SETI proponents acknowledged the problem. Peter Schenkel wrote in a 2006 piece for Skeptical Inquirer, a magazine that strongly affirms atheism, "In light of new findings and insights, we should quietly admit that the early estimates may no longer be tenable. Today, there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. For example, without a massive gravity-rich planet like Jupiter nearby to draw away asteroids, Earth would be more like an interstellar dartboard than the verdant orb that it is. Simply put, the odds against life in the universe are astonishing. Yet, here we are, not only existing, but talking about existing. What can account for it? Can every one of those many parameters have been perfectly met by accident? At what point is it fair to admit that it is science itself that suggests that we cannot be the result of random forces? Doesn't assuming that an intelligence created these perfect conditions in fact require far less faith than believing that a life-sustaining Earth just happened to beat the inconceivable odds? But wait, there's more. The fine-tuning necessary for life to exist on a planet is nothing compared with the fine-tuning required for the universe to exist at all. For example, astrophysicists now know that the values of the four fundamental forces, gravity, the electromagnetic force, and the strong and weak nuclear forces, were determined less than 1/1,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang. Alter any one of these four values ever so slightly, and the universe as we know it could not exist. For instance, if the ratio between the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force had been off by the tiniest fraction of the tiniest inconceivable fraction, then no stars could have formed at all. Multiply that single parameter by all the other necessary conditions, and the odds against the universe existing are so heart-stoppingly astronomical that the notion that it all just happened defies common sense. It would be like tossing a coin and having it come up heads 10 quintillion times in a row. I don't think so. Fred Hoyle, the astronomer who coined the term Big Bang, said that his atheism was greatly shaken by these developments. One of the world's most renowned theoretical physicists, Paul Davies, has said that the appearance of design is overwhelming. Even the late Christopher Hitchens, one of atheism's most aggressive proponents, conceded that without question the fine-tuning argument was the most powerful argument of the other side. Oxford University professor of mathematics, Dr. John Lennox, has said, "The more we get to know about our universe, the more the hypothesis that there is a creator gains in credibility as the best explanation of why we are here." The greatest miracle of all time is the universe. It is the miracle of all miracles, one that inescapably points to something or someone beyond itself. I'm Eric Metaxas for Prager University.
Well, let me pray for us. Lord, thank you. We expect that your universe would cry out that you are alive. Thank you that you've introduced yourself to us. May we be faithful to introduce you to others. In Jesus' name, amen.